now we turn to the third issue that's found on page 31, the opening of the chapter, chapter 2. More than anything else, Christianity is a love song. And then that whole paragraph is just a beautiful way of expressing what it is. People shy away, she says, from saying that out loud. Christianity is a love song. And you can hear people saying, yeah, sure. It might be a little sentimental, a little embarrassing, she says. Or it may have radical implications. But in recent survey, more than three quarters of young churchgoers identify Christianity as judgmental, hypocritical, out of touch, insensitive, boring, and exclusive. That's young people. And it's up to people of our age to show that that isn't really what we are. Love is what Jesus preached, she writes, and what he embodied. In the early church, devout Christians tried to embody God's love and to experience God in such a way that God, not the church, reshapes their life. Now, I believe when it went before, I mentioned to you that there might be a time when someone does maybe need to be, quote, excommunicated. If that happens, whoever does it should do it with tears in their eyes. It's like parents saying to one of their kids, you just cause problems, called tough love. You're not welcome back here until you turn around. And the mother and father do that with tears in their eyes. This is my boy. But they realize that there's something that he needs that they can't give and haven't been able to give or whatever it is. It just happens too often that what we do is, in the church, quickly, you're excommunicated. That's wrong. That isn't acceptable. The early church, and she mentions that in that passage here, the early church cannot be held up as the ideal. Paul, he became a Christian, a follower of Jesus, at least, maybe not a Christian in our sense of the term, but a follower of Jesus. He was very Jewish, stayed Jewish, around 40, just 10 years after the death of Jesus. 10 years. He writes a letter to the Thessalonians, the first letter to the Thessalonians, which is the very first written document we have by any follower of Jesus. The Gospels all come later. 70, Gospel of John 90, kind of thing. So in 50, he writes the letter, and that says, in the early church, devout Christians tried to embody God's love and to experience God in such a way that love reshaped their lives. That's a little bit too idealizing. If in the year 50, Paul wrote to the Thessalonians, he was saying, you're okay, but a few years later he wrote to the Corinthians. And when he writes the letter to the Corinthians, about 54, you Corinthians aren't worth much at all. So it is not an ideal community. And the data we have is right there in the New Testament that shows those early followers of Jesus as a group probably had the same ups and downs, ins and outs, that we have. Here's what Jesus said, who cares? You know, I'm the boss, you do this. No moment of life in the followers of Jesus is ideal. Would you say that the group in this room is ideal? Of course. You know, of course. And if you don't believe that, take a look at it. Absolutely, that's right. And we know we're not. Interesting, though, how that happens. Now, some comments on the book itself. The first is that love shapes our life. Or I like to use the phrase, shapes and colors. Shapes and colors and structures. That's what that is. And really, I want to use that with our theology, our understanding of God. Ultimately, the church does not shape culture, structure, our life. God shapes colors and structures our life. We find this in all the great writers of the church. Their theology of God shapes, colors, and structures everything else they say about their theology. Creation, salvation, Jesus, incarnation, moral life. In other words, in the back of a mind like Basil, Gregory, Thomas Aquinas, Augustine, Bonaventure, Scotus, in the back of the mind, they have this theology of God, and it's with through that lens of how they understand God that they see what creation is, human life is, etc. That was changed at the time of the Reformation when we started writing these little books on the church. We never had one before. There was no book by Augustine, Basil, Thomas, Bonaventure, etc. on the church. They mentioned church, but they had a book on the sacraments, they had a book on Jesus, they had a book on the last things, they had a book on the angels, Thomas Aquinas, huge book, you know, book on creation. They never wrote a book on the church until 1600. And then, when they started writing these books on the church, Catholics wrote books on the church saying, we're the true church, you're not. And the Lutherans over here, we're Lutherans, said, no, we're the true church, Roman Catholics are not, nor are the Calvinists, nor are those Baptists. And then the Calvinists over here, you thought you were getting away with not doing anything. You Calvinists over here, you know, you're saying, we're the true church, not the Lutherans, not the Catholics, not the Baptists, and so on, and so on, and so on. Every one of those church books is apologetic, defensive. We have the right God. You don't have God. We have the sacraments. You don't have the sacraments. That's a big thing. And if you baptized, it wasn't worth anything. That was the change. 1600, 1700, 1800, 1950. And during that, those 300 years, and if you add 50 years into the 1500s, those 400 years, God was not the lens through which you saw everything, but this view of the church, my church, our church, not your church, that's the lens through which everything was done. And their goal was to the catechism to make sure that you, Baltimore Catechism people, like myself, that you spoke with the Roman Catholic Church, not the Anglican. The same is very true of the Catechism of the Catholic Church that came out not too many years ago. Mm. You look up in the index of the Catechism of the Catholic Church, there's about four pages about other religions and other denominations. They don't call them churches, mm-hmm. except the Orthodox. The rest is all, this is what we Catholics said. Today, in ordinary living, one of the greatest things in the world is the ecumenical movement. And we didn't start that. It was started by the Anglicans. And out of that, with the Anglicans, then you got the, what's that big church thing out of Switzerland now?
World Council of Churches.
Came out of them. And even to this very day, the Catholic Church does not belong to the World Council of Churches. It's not a member. We have observers. they go there to observe and then, let the Vatican know what's happening. And then we have people who are on the committee. So a lot of material is here. But officially, Rome has not said we can be a member. Because then it says all religions are the same. Mm-hmm. That's the reason for it. But isn't it a wonderful thing that people who believe in Jesus talk to each other? This is where the people's church, not the big C church, is taking over. That's the first great thing of what's happening right now and why I'm excited about being alive, even 80 years old. The second great thing, never have we done this before. Never. We've had interreligion dialogues, but not on a universal basis as we're having today. Globalization used to be Spain came to the New World and took over the land from the Nahuatl and Aztecs, etc. That was globalization. Mm-hmm. And Spain globalized. And globalized. China globalized. Took over Vietnam for 1,000 years. And when the Chinese finally left, the Vietnamese said, "We're still Vietnamese." They were not Chinese. Even though they had been under Chinese rule for 1,000 years. There's been a lot of gobbling, globaling. But today, globalization is universal. In the rice paddies of Malaysia, they're out there drinking Coca-Cola and talking on their cell phone. And it's true. I'm on the board for a Jesuit priest from Madagascar, getting his doctorate, and he's talking about the effect of globalization on Madagascar. Some of us don't even know where Madagascar is. And yet it's very globalized. On the other hand, it has wonderful fauna and foliage. Globalization is coming. You can't do anything without considering it's going to have repercussions around the world. In the Chancery Office of the Diocese, you're not going to be able to do something and not have it have repercussions. Mm-hmm. In the diocese and beyond it. In the Catholic group and beyond it. It's a globalized world that we live in. And see, the globalization can be, we're going to globalize and we don't see the guy at the side of the road who needs help. Mm. Many people in Africa today feel that Africa is the forgotten country. Mm. Globalization, when we were able to get stuff out of it, but now that they have their own little groups with their own leaders, you know, even getting the oil out of Nigeria has caused problems, anger, poverty, etc. We're much more concerned about how China is getting stronger than the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And if only they'd sort of let their money, you know, go a little bit higher, whatever it is, we'd have good quality, which means we would have better prospects for our industries. Nobody looks at globalization from a nice, beautiful way. We're all looking at it from our own little way, kind of thing.
And before we get too far away from early Christianity, I'd like to ask you one question.
Sure.
About Jesus' teachings. It just struck me when you went over the story of the Good Samaritan that found the person that was in acute need of care,
yeah,
bleeding and all beaten. And it struck me that a lot of our parables, a goat or a cow falls into the well, you've got to do something immediately. A lot of the parables of Jesus seem to refer to acute crises and intervening. And I'm wondering, do you know of any tradition or parables that might talk more to the chronic as opposed to the acute? More to the endemic as opposed to the critical? I'm finding that a little difficult right now.
That's a very good point, because as a storyteller, he uses acuteness,
yeah,
you know, sharpness. It makes the story a little more,
mm-hmm,
a little more rigid.
You know, a lot of our human lives are not necessarily stories of emergency rooms.
No, if they're not. And you know, the Cana wedding, that was they're going to lose what? All the wine kind of thing. Honor shame entered into that whole thing.
The banquets. That's every day.
Who's, yeah. We don't have banquets every day. You know, we have fast food every day.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
But who do we let into our daily lives? You know, that banquet, that's one of the most important gospel passages. You know why? Who do you have to invite?
Right.
The blind.
Yeah. But again, it was a banquet with the people that should have come were saying, we're not coming, and so you went out to the byways and everything else to invite these people in. Now, the place where you see the ordinary people in the gospel would be Jesus coming into a village. And who came out to hear him? The nameless people, mm-hmm, the ordinary people. And it was those people that he said, that he preached to for the kingdom of God. He used most often the parables for some other people that came out, who were the priests, the lawyers,
mm-hmm,
and the Pharisees. And most of those parables are directed to them. Because they're maintaining these strict regulations. Yes?
I was thinking about when he said to leave the children be around
children.
Them. And that's
the ordinary children. Yeah. But there's one thing about that I've always considered. Jesus took the children, blessed them, and gave them back. Grandmas and grandpas. take the children, you bless them, you're happy with them, and you give them back and say, thank God.
In the course of patterns of things that we see Jesus doing consistently in his ministry that sort of give us the guidelines rather than specific instances. For instance, the inclusivity, the fact that he met needs and healed people consistently, that seems to be what gives us our kind of guidelines, how we follow.
The people that followed him, and that he left following them, were ordinary gum-chewing Jews.
Mm-hmm.
You know, men and women. And people that, the upper crust, 10% of the upper crust of all of Palestine, 10% were the wealthy, 90% were not wealthy at all. These are just ordinary people. And that's the people's church.
Mm.
Yeah. But you don't really see that. And then when you read the history as you go along, very often those people don't even have a voice in the explanation of church history.
Yeah, we sometimes talk about walking the walk as well as talking the talk.
Yeah.
And I think maybe the people's church is the one that walks the walk.
That's right. Now, one of our Franciscans, whom some of you may know, Joe Canici, mm-hmm. historian, okay, he and one of his doctoral students, a woman, after she got her doctorate, they put out a book together of the church in 1800 here in the United States, but taken from diaries of ordinary people, the prayer books of ordinary people, letters of ordinary people. They went through a lot of archival material that didn't have, you know, they're from the bishop or the pastor or whatever. Just things that, you know, you found that your grandma had and it's been saved and stuff like that. And this is how they lived Christianity. And you sort of see a different, and, you know, we're not worried about, does this fit in with canon number 237? They're not worried about that. It just is the right way to do it at this time. Or they did a little bit, other people have done, on the nuns in the United States that came into the Midwest to set up schools. So you got one of these towns already there, and the stagecoach comes, and here come these nuns with their little habits on, you know, and they don't have hardly anything money-wise, etc. And they start the school, and the people are crying because they want their kids to get a good education. But what those women suffered just during that time, you know. And so Mother Mary Gladiola would write, you know, a little diary, and you'd find that and see what they went through, you know. And they'd ask the bishop for some money, and he would say, I don't have any money to give you, but we want you to do this, you know. And some of them, you know, didn't even have food to eat. There's been a couple of instances where the nun died of malnutrition. So it's seeing that kind of activity of where people are. You have some books today which are very good, and these books today would be on feminist views of the church. Now, some of them would be, you know, women who have positions, but others are just ordinary mothers, grandmothers that are asked to write that kind of a book. And you have groups like yourself, even. This is people's church going on right here.
I think in reference to Tom's question, Jesus' teachings. I think the way he dealt with women, I think most of those are non-acute, except maybe the woman who was going to be stoned. But his teaching was, let you without sin be the first to cast the stone. So he saved the woman's life, but really the teaching went way beyond that.
The other thing you have to realize is that erasure Jesus was born maybe two before Christ, one before Christ, or one after Christ. Somewhere in here is where he was born. He died maybe 28, 29, 30, 31. We really don't have exact dates on the time and things. Somewhere 1 B.C. is even more important than 1 A.D. by the scholars. That's how they did this. And then he might have died either 39 or 31 is even more than 30. Okay. As I mentioned to you, Paul wrote in the 50s. That's the first document that we have. And so he died in the 60s. So 50 to 60, this is sort of the Pauline area. In 70, you have the destruction of the temple, 68, 69, and 70. You have the destruction of the temple. And it's after this that you get Mark, Matthew, Luke. And then, so 70 to 80, and 90 to 100 is John. Now, when they're writing these Gospels at that time, they're not writing history as we would know it. Jesus up on July 4th, 27 AD, we think, you know, did this. They're not writing that. They're writing a history of Jesus and what Jesus taught for the community in which they lived. And it was meant, like in Mark's Gospel, it was meant to draw together the way the people in that community understood Jesus, and this is what keeps us together in the year 71, say. Or for Luke, in the year 72-3. Matthew, in the year 72-73. And they had Mark's Gospel in front of them, and they said, well, Mark wrote this, but we have a different slant. And they're facing some of the problems of the community of that day. That's why they highlight this parable, or highlight that parable. Who is the Pharisee in Matthew's Gospel, for instance? That's Palestine. Here's Jerusalem. Here's Samaria in the middle. And here's Galilee up here. Okay. No, it's up here. This was a big port city, Caesarea Maritima. Huge port that the Romans built. And from here, you went up to the lower part of Galilee where Jesus was teaching. And you went over to Damascus, and you went out to Babylon, and from Babylon you went up to Afghanistan, to China, you came down to India, this way. It was part of the Silk Road. Okay? Matthew seems to have written his gospel in Caesarea Maritima. After the destruction of the temple, the Jewish scholars came in a town called Jamnia. This is where the Pharisees were and the rabbis. And they had to move out. They were going to be killed in Jerusalem. And some of them would come up, and there was this big clash between the Pharisees of 74-5 and Matthew's community. He's writing the things about the Pharisees, not because it happened at the time of Jesus with such strength, but because he was having problems with these Pharisees that came up there and were saying, you followers of Jesus, you're not really the true one. You have to take that into consideration. That's sort of the, as you say in German, Sittenleben, of when they were writing.
It sounds to me like there was a lot of acute and critical stuff going on while those Gospels were being written.
There was a lot of difficulties. You had this whole question, should we take in the Greeks, non-Jewish people? You know, that was going on.
Circumcision,
all of those kinds of things, yeah. Is this really Jewish? Not Jewish? That was one of the big things. And then the idea of who rules. John did not like the Matthew communities. So you've got a little bit of, you know, the Archdiocese of Los Angeles, may not like the Archdiocese of San Francisco. Similarly, got a lot of, as you're saying, these things show up. In, you know, why they put the question mark, the exclamation point, or why they make it that in such a sharp way on that point. Marriage was another thing. Yeah.
Are you familiar with Alexander Shire's material?
A little bit.
Because he has some influence here in Santa Barbara, and I'm curious, what do you think of the scholarship?
The scholarship is okay. You know? When you bring some of this, well, you know, Matthew was writing for his community. And that's why he put it this way or that way. You're saying, you mean Jesus didn't say exactly that? Yeah, that's true, because he was writing in Greek. You know? And if you take just a little sentence from English and try to put it into Spanish, it's going to change. Put it into French, it's going to change. Into German, it's going to change. Any change of language changes it. So you have to say, did Jesus, are these really the very words of Jesus? They're close. But we really don't say that. Joachim Jeremias, a good German scholar, says, well, we do know two words that Jesus said. Amen. Because that's a Hebrew word. And what was the other one? Abba. Yeah, Abba. For God. Again, that's an Aramaic word rather than a Hebrew word. Yeah. So that we would know. Yeah. But he's being very careful.
Yeah. Well, his point is not nearly so much, as I took it, that, because I think that's been done by other people before.
Right.
But this notion of there is really four different gospels, and that each of those answer a different time in the church.
That's right.
And you would
they each different time, different place.
Uh-huh.
The timing of the first three is 70 to 80, so the timing is there, but the places are a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't have the communication we have today. This is way big. This is a law of the flesh, which is, you know, they got a lot of Greek stuff in there already. Yeah.
I'm just wondering if a lot of what we read and hear in the Gospels and is used on a regular basis in the cycle of church is more reactionary events or things that you can draw from less reflective of the early church. It's less spiritual and more reactionary. Like this happened and this is what Jesus said. So it's like critical or acute more, because those are the things that get remembered more than the ordinary.
It's remembered, but it's remembered and expressed in a way that is going to meet a pastoral concern of that area. Yeah.
But the concern, I'm wondering if Tom is, are you getting at maybe what about world hunger and what about the level of response to root problems rather than...
Well, I just was remarking on the fact that I'm not familiar with any gospel stories that extol the virtues of long-term endurance. You know, everything is like a sudden crisis. Let's deal with it. I do think, however, that Diana Butler Bass has some good points to make about the way that being a follower of Christ was following a way, and that meant walking, and that meant enduring, and that meant, you know. So I mean, it's implied in there.
Yeah, but you have to think of one other thing here. Jesus did deliberately want to have a following of people. Whether we can call it church or not in his time, that's a whole other question. Was it a sect? I don't think it was a sect. But it was a community. The people up in Galilee, they were interconnected as a group. Just as this group is sort of a community. It's a community kind of thing. Jesus wanted that. And that community, not just himself, but the community, in their common way of looking at things, was confrontational to Jewish leadership. And he knew that. And the people who followed Jesus, ordinary fisher folk, people kind of thing, they knew that they were coming into a way that their leaders disagreed with, to some degree, kind of thing. But the reason why they liked the approach of Jesus was his view of God responded more to what they thought God should be, rather than a God of law, God of regulation, God of this kind of thing, and a God that is open more to women, other people, ordinary kind of things. Now see, Jesus is not alone in that, because you had all sorts of, not all sorts, but I say at the time of Jesus there would have been at least five or six other groups like that. The Pharisees started like one of those groups, because they didn't like the leaders. They were lay people who formed a little group, still within Judaism, but they weren't following what the high priest and the scribes and the senator were saying, kind of thing. So there is something counter authority about the followers of Jesus. It's built in to each of them, not just in Jesus himself.
We still got it.
I mean, that's what we're still got it. Yeah. And if we didn't have it, we really wouldn't be followers of Jesus.
For me, one of the strongest points of the Jesus stories is that constant theme of change your way of thinking. Don't think like the world does or the Pharisees. I'm going to give you a new way to see things. Mm-hmm. You know, the metanoia.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that's where the daily life, the ordinary message comes in.
Right, yeah. And you have to remember this. You look at a lot of the changes in the church that today we say, oh, isn't this wonderful? Give you one example. The sacrament of reconciliation. Mm-hmm. You know? You have to go to confession, you know, once a year. That's the law. But you really should go every month or go every week. You know? And pushing frequent confession. For the first 800 years, 900 years, most Christians didn't even go once. But when it became, the Irish brought that in. The Irish brought that frequent confession. When the Irish view of confession took over around 900, 1000, you know, the church still didn't say officially that's the way it was, but everybody was doing it. Even Italians, they were doing it. Until finally they said you have to go to confession once a year. Yeah. Then they admitted there was frequent confession. Otherwise, the real confession was you could go once in your lifetime, period. So we look back and say, isn't confession a major part of our way of living? Now, isn't it terrible we don't have frequent confession? I mean, what is the church coming to anyway? I'm just going to say, wait a minute. The things that we take as being ordinary, at one time, might have been extraordinary. And a lot of the stuff is that way. Yes. So, ladies and gentlemen, it's now new time. Once again, I just want to say what a joy to be with you. And I hope that you just don't get any older and you just stay for the next 200 years.